The term active refers to those who have not taken senior status and therefore go into quasi-retirement. It's very quasi because all of our senior judges work very hard. They, however, do not take the full load of an active circuit judge. The Fifth Circuit, in which, by the way, Texas lies, at least at present. I say at present because one of the propositions before Congress today in the very same judgeship bill I mentioned to you is to divide the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth runs through the entire tier of southern states, beginning and including Texas through Florida. It has 15 active judges. It, too, is expanding very significantly in terms of judicial personnel if Congress enacts the pending legislation. Although each federal judge primarily sits in his or her own territory, all of us can sit on any federal court in the United States other than the Supreme Court of the United States upon assignment by the Chief Justice and with our consent. Because my court is one of the most overburdened, if not the most overburdened in the country, we regularly use services of visiting judges, and active judges of my circuit sit on no other court because we cannot justify being away from the court as heavily burdened as it is to go help anybody else. The federal appellate courts hear an almost incredible menu of litigation. To just give you a handful of illustrations of subject matter, we hear cases involving aliens and immigration, antitrust cases, copyright and patent cases, a tremendous array of federal criminal cases, admiralty cases. For those not familiar with admiralty, involves collisions of ships at sea, all kinds of maritime torts, concerns about oil spills, and other such things. Federal securities cases, claims involving interstate and international waters, federal land claims, all sorts of actions by and against the United States government, prisoner cases, school integration cases, environmental cases, claims by and against Indians, voting rights cases, and an enormous volume of litigation concerning the construction and application of federal statutes, and an endless litany of constitutional claims. The amount of litigation concerning women's rights pending in the federal courts today is very substantial. The truly dramatic rise in the amount of cases affecting women's issues has occurred primarily within the last decade. The generative forces for litigating these issues has occurred much earlier due to very, very substantial changes in the roles and activities of women, due to the development of public interest law firms, due to the development of women's entry not only in more substantial positions in business and industry and in the labor force, but also into the legal profession. But I think if I had to pick a particular moment which perhaps made the difference, it would be the creation in 1961 of the Presidential Commission on the Status of Women, chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt. The commission's report, published in 1963, certainly dissipated anybody's lingering notions that women in the United States were in any respect equal citizens with equal justice. That report documented egregious discrimination against women in employment, education, social insurance, taxation, protective labor laws, and in civil and political rights, to name only a few. And at least partially attributable to the findings of that commission was the enactment of the Equal Pay Act of 1963, requiring, as you know, equal pay for equal work in a wide range of private, industrial, and business organizations. The Equal Employment Opportunity Act, Title VII, of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, as initially drafted, forbade discrimination on account of race, religion, and national origin in employment, but sex discrimination was very conspicuously absent. It was only after a heated debate that sex discrimination was added, and there is truth in the suspicion that the reason that sex discrimination was added was to defeat the bill. Nevertheless, no doubt much to the astonishment of the proponents of the addition of the sex discrimination, the bill passed, and though it has all kinds of crags and furrows, Title VII has nevertheless become a cornerstone for the entering wedges upon obtaining equal opportunity for women in employment. To be sure, the nature of the difficulties of enacting that statute are perfectly obvious when you read the statute itself in its earlier regulations, because it is a jungle of incompetent draftsmanship. It is impossible to believe that those who sponsored the legislation could really have wanted to help women in employment, because the nature of the draftsmanship is so miserably bad that the explanation can be much more rationally given as a basis to avoid the potential for a workmanlike job in the legislation. Nevertheless, amendments have been forthcoming. We've heard a great deal about them during this conference, and I think the steam that has been generated by the women's movement, together with the responsible reactions of women in conferences like this, well, there's nothing been like this, but as close to this as we can, is going to make it increasingly difficult for members of Congress to turn their backs on the issues affecting women. After the enactment of the earlier two statutes, as you know, Congress has passed a whole rash of statutes, each of which has had sufficiently difficult questions of interpretation to generate a very substantial amount of litigation in the federal courts. During the same era, discriminatory practices against women have been challenged under the United States Constitution in involving the use of the Equal Protection Clause of the federal Constitution, but also the constitutional right of privacy and the Due Process Clause. Lawsuits have been initiated to obtain such fundamental benefits as really equal pay for equal work, regardless of statutory limitations, to obtain medical care, welfare benefits, to remove barriers such as sex-based restrictions on school enrollment, height and strength for standards for employment, limitations on scholarship eligibility, limitations on dependents benefits for members of the armed forces and other federal service personnel, and a myriad of other concerns which deeply affect women. These lawsuits have really had a great deal to do with all aspects of women's condition in the workforce, in education, voting, property ownership, credit, and many other facets of American life. Yet, all of these victories, great and small, have been virtually eclipsed in the public mind by the enormous publicity given to two sensitive and extremely emotionally charged issues, which, as you well know, are pregnancy and abortion. Few decisions in the turbulent history of the United States Supreme Court has evoked more impassioned controversy than the court's decisions concerning abortion. Roe against Wade and its companion case invalidating laws forbidding or criminally punishing abortions during the first trimester of pregnancy and in limiting regulations and statutes affecting abortions in later periods of pregnancy, and Beal against Doe and Maher against Roe, holding that neither states nor the federal government are constitutionally compelled to fund abortions, have been subjects of both struggle, controversy, rage, triumph, depending upon whose point of view is being espoused. The pregnancy cases have also provoked an uproar, but these cases do not involve the same kind of moral, religious, or emotional convictions as did the abortion cases. I refer, when I talk about pregnancy cases, to those which concern the very distinctive and indeed discriminatory treatment given to pregnant women with respect to employment practices, including such things as sick pay, medical benefits, employment leave, vacation policy, seniority rights, all of which could not more deeply concern the welfare of women, but which at the same time do not, which involve more economic concerns, both to the employer and to the employee, than they do the massively morally charged issues of the abortion cases. One of the most important cases in this field was decided last term. term in General Electric against Gilbert, in which the Supreme Court was asked to decide whether the exclusion of pregnancy-related disabilities from coverage under a private employer disability program constituted sex discrimination under Title VII. The majority of the court held that the exclusion of the pregnancy-related disabilities did not have that effect. Fine, thank you. How long was it? 15. That decision by the majority holding that pregnancy-related disabilities did not have the effect of discriminating against women has been very widely criticized, not only for the substance of the analysis by the Supreme Court majority, but also by those who disagree with the outcome. To be sure, it's extremely difficult intellectually to defend a basic concept of the majority opinion that pregnancy is not sex-based. I find myself shaking my head about that. There are, nevertheless, a great many problems left over, and these issues are now pending in numerous numbers before the United States Courts of Appeals, and there are pending two of such cases this term before the Supreme Court of the United States. The intensity of these controversies and the great difficulties that the courts have had in deciding them shouldn't surprise anybody. Even more intensive than our emotional responses to racial discrimination are the depths of our concerns about birth, death, the relationship of men and women relating to conception and birth, and to the competition between the sexes, together with the definitions and appropriate roles of both. We are not alone in this. Societies all over the world are grappling with these intensely human problems. Until very recently in human history, decisions were left to divine providence to determine matters of birth and death, in part, if not wholly, because human beings did not know how to intervene in these procedures. Technological developments have turned that around. And in turning it around, we still have not reached consensus about how to think about these problems, let alone how to decide them. But bear in mind that courts never operate with consensus. If there were consensus, there would not be a justiciable controversy. That means, of course, that courts are always, and as far as I can see, always will be, in the eye of the storm of controversy. One thing I will close with before I invite questions is simply to point out that it is difficult sometimes for people to realize the extent of the reality of the constraints that operate on courts. It is simply beside the point whether I, as a judge, personally agree or disagree with a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. I am bound to follow it whether I agree or whether I don't. Lower courts nevertheless have opportunities to pave the way to significant decisions in many, many different kinds of cases, long before the Supreme Court has decided the problem is sufficiently ripe for it to undertake. Another feature is that courts have the extreme restraint that courts cannot appropriate one nickel. We can award damages from one private party to another, or in some instances, damage against the United States. But when it comes to implementing any of the social programs which we are talking about, one always must remember that while we can shut down the factory polluting the stream, we haven't got a penny to relocate the people whose lives may be totally dependent upon that mill. We cannot appropriate anything, which suggests to you, I hope, that while courts can be catalytic agents for social change, while courts can direct people to perform the duties that they swore they were going to do in heaven, the powers of our compulsion are not endless. And therefore, while I think that the federal courts have indeed deserved the confidence rating in which they are presently held, I think one also must recognize that there are substantial limitations on how much the federal courts, no matter who sits on the benches, can do to become ultimate solvents of the extreme problems of the human condition. Yet, it seems to me that if, for those of us who may feel as I do, that the foundation stone of the United States really lies in the degree to which we not only say, but we implement our belief in the fundamental values of the Bill of Rights, their courts can become a continuing moral force in the country. And the extent to which we abandon those notions, we have also abandoned any conviction that we are indeed a country striving towards equal justice for all. I'll be glad to answer whatever questions you may wish to throw this way. Yes. Well, it depends upon, if you're talking about state courts, it depends upon what states you're in. Because the way in which a person becomes a member of a state court has as many variations as Darwin's singular group of finches. In some states, it is one must be attached to a particular political party to become a person who can be a candidate for judicial office. In still others, can you hear me without it? If I just speak up. All right. In still others, the primary methodology is to become significantly recognized within the individual's community of lawyers so as to have lawyers forward your candidacy with respect to the gubernatorial appointing powers. In the federal courts, it's a very difficult proposition because, historically at least, a person, male or female, could not be appointed successfully to the federal court, with very rare exceptions, unless the individual was a member of the political party of the President of the United States. And if the senators from that individual state of residence also agreed, or at least did not seriously disagree, and if you also got the full extent of clearances from the Department of Justice, the American Bar Association, and if both of your senators were members of a party which is not the party of the president, also the okay of the entire congressional delegation that is of the party of the president. So it is not a simple kind of process. But there have been and still are occasions in which presidents, not being blind any more than senators are to political concerns in a broader construct, have been obliged to accept a truly qualified person opposite the party of the president, or have to face some very rough questions come along next election time. I'm sorry, I can answer that more fully in a particular way, but I don't think I can do it without taking up more time than all of you necessarily want to devote to it. Yes. Well, but they only decided in Gilbert, the Supreme Court only decided in Gilbert that the particular plan with respect to pregnancy benefits did not discriminate against women, certain kinds of private health care plans. What we have now before us and what the Supreme Court has before us are matters of discrimination involving such matters as these. A woman who becomes pregnant taking pregnancy leave does not maintain her seniority in employment, but loses her seniority during the entire time she's out, and she's then in no situation to bump another person who's been put in her slot. And the only reason she's lost that seniority is because, unlike any other temporary disability, pregnancy is left out. Another question is whether or not constitutionally companies, both, this involves both public and private employment now, you see, so you've got different kinds of cases and different sorts of plans, as to whether or not one can refuse to use accumulated medical leave for pregnancy, even though you can use accumulated medical leave for anything else, which involves illness or surgery or whatever. So that there are just a host of endless variations on this particular theme, and in which I think the court is going to find it rather more difficult in dealing, for instance, with public employment. The court has not dealt with public employment yet. So that there are a whole host of problems which are very much on the horizon. Most of us in the federal courts, of course, who already have cases of this sort pending, defer submission of those cases until the Supreme Court decides, because those cases are affecting these decisions are now pending. Yes.
Your name was mentioned
when Carter was in his cabinet and as a potential attorney general, and I'm wondering if now that would seem difficult to be, what would be your decision to stay on the bench with the Supreme Court? Well, you know, I feel a little bit in that connection as a quip was about a woman who had had a hysterectomy and was asked what she would name her next child if she had one. General Bell is indicating no disposition whatever to leave, and I have no idea what is in the mind of the president. Well, I can say that I would find it very difficult to wish to leave the bench simply because I've had a career, not quite 20 years, on the bench, and I happen to be deeply interested in the scholarly work, and I'm not a political figure. I'm a kind of apolitical type. Had I taken a different career pattern, it might very well have been a different story, but as you've no doubt heard in other contexts from other people, judges, particularly federal judges, are simply not permitted to enter the public scene, and we are very actively discouraged in every way from having any publicity whatever. It is supposed to be Operation Low Profile. Yes. Yes, I was in private practice, specializing. The question was, how did I end up being a federal judge? And the answer is, I developed a practice of my own, as well as being associated with a firm in which my husband also was associated, as a specialist in litigation. And I had, most of my clients were all lawyers for whom I did a wide variety of sophisticated litigation. And that particular course led me ultimately to being one of four persons who headed up the whole brief writing program and a set of the most complex litigation that the country has undertaken in the lawsuit between Arizona, California, and multiple other western states over the water rights of the Colorado River, a case tried in the original jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court, a project that took a very long time indeed. And as a result of that, it happened because it went on so long that Earl Warren was governor of California when I began that case. He had been attorney general when the case began. And Edmund G. Pat Brown, the senior Brown, was attorney general also, with a result that I came to know well many of the leading figures who ultimately were in a situation to have more than slight say in the appointing process. And then, of course, I spent some years on the bench, and it is no mystery that then as now, there was considerable political understanding that appointing a female who was conspicuously well qualified was not a bad thing to do. And you see, there were so very, very few of us that those of us who had stuck our head ups were rather visible. That's how. Yes. I have supported the ERA in published works, and yes, I do support it. And Susan Anthony thought it might be enough too, and she didn't prove to be right. It is, of course, at the same time, as I've also said publicly, and I will repeat publicly, ERA needs to be done because it's the right thing to do. It's just. But it would be a mistake to assume that ERA is going to eradicate many of the intractable problems that we have, because it won't. It will neither do the evils of which it has been accused, nor will it be the great universal solvent for which it has sometimes been sold as the hope. But it will make a significant difference in how particular legal issues are perceived by courts. For example, Mr. Justice Powell, writing in Fronchero and others, indicated that the reason that he was not going to go the direction of deciding that sex was a suspect classification for constitutional purposes did so on the specific basis that the issue was going to be resolved politically by the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, that I give you that as a very sharp illustration of why I think it will make a difference. Yes. Yes. It happens that I believe that women ought to be, in every sense, full and equal citizens of the United States. I believe in equal justice for all. I don't believe in equal justice for some. I mean it. Yes.
I was troubled by a statement made earlier that with trivial exceptions, appellate courts don't consider cases which involve innocent defendants.
They can't get there.
Well, they've been convicted, it's true, but it's many, if not most, claim that they're innocent and that their conviction was only based upon the unreliable evidence of misconduct on the part of prosecutors and so on. Don't you feel that many of the cases you consider do involve
Well, what I was trying to say really is that guilt or innocence is genuinely irrelevant in terms of the legal issues which are involved. The most critical legal issue most often is whether or not the person, for a variety of reasons, had a fair trial. A person, even though guilty, ultimately guilty, is entitled to a fair trial. Now, there's been a great deal of discussion about whether or not innocence is irrelevant on collateral attack. That's another subject. And since my time has expired, I'll be glad to speak to anybody else who wants to talk about such things after we call this session to a close. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be with you, and especially the extraordinarily kind attention which each of you have given me during this session, much of which admittedly was quite technical, but alas, what I really do is esoteric. I began to realize how esoteric when my late mother, who really wanted to know what I do, really asked me, and I really tried to tell her. And when her eyes began to glaze somewhat, I figured I had it. Thank you.
It has indeed been a pleasure to have the highest woman judge in the United States of America with us. And, pardon?